This is Fresh Air. Environmentalists have made us aware of how precious the disappearing rainforest is. Stephen Feld has found something precious in the rainforest that environmentalists don't usually mention: music. Since the mid-70s, Feld has been studying and recording the music of the Kalali people in the Bonsavi rainforest of Papua New Guinea. He's made 4 trips there over the past 15 years. His original research just earned him a MacArthur Award, commonly referred to as the Genius Award. Feld is an ethnomusicologist, and his recordings of Kalali song have been available to fellow academics. But now the rest of us can hear this music. Some of his recent recordings have been released on compact disc by a world music label run by Mickey Hart, who was a drummer with the Grateful Dead. Feld's new record, Voices of the Rainforest, shows a day in the life of the Kalali people. Before we hear the songs of the people, let's hear Feld's recording of the sounds of the rainforest itself. You say that the Kalali people think of themselves as voices in the forest. What do they mean by that?
It means that they're not distinct from the world of sound that they live in. It means that they sing with the birds, they sing with the insects, they sing with the water, and when they sing along with them, they try and sing like them. They're inspired by them, but they're also part of the same musical soundscape. They're not distinct from them, either spiritually or musically.
They even have a word, don't they, for this kind of multi-tracking of sounds that goes on naturally in the rainforest?
Right. This is the term they use to refer to all music, whether it's the music of nature or the nature of their own music, and it's duluguganalan, which means lift up over sounding. I know that's an awkward translation, but there's no better one. It just means that every sound is dense and layered and overlapping and interlocking and alternating, that no sounds are discrete, that you hear everything in this very deeply blended way.
Well, let me play another example of what you're describing here as singing with the natural sounds. And this is a woman singing by a creek.
Right.
Talk about the kind of singing here and what's important about it.
Well, what's important about water is you can't walk for more than a few minutes in the rainforest without crossing some kind of stream. And the Bosavi people say that songs are like water. Songs flow like waterfalls. They say when they compose songs, it's like getting a waterfall in their head. So creek sides are a favorite place for composing, and they're also a favorite place for singing and thinking about songs. And this is a kind of relaxing, but they're also singing with the water. It's sort of like choosing a nice waterfall is like choosing a good Steinway. It's an activity meant to kind of enhance the aesthetic experience of the activity of composing and singing. And that's what we have here at this creek. This woman has just composed this song, and she's trying it out, with a nice gurgling stream.
Let's hear some of it. We're listening to part of Steve Feld's recording called Voices of the Rainforest, recorded among the Kalali people in Papua New Guinea. Now, since you started going there in the 1970s, things have begun to change. I think one of the big changes in that area is that oil was discovered under the rainforest. What effect is that having on the lives of the people you've been working with?
Well, potentially, this massive discovery of major oil reserves in an area about 25 miles away from the Basavi region is going to have extraordinary consequences. It's a very major oil reserve. 150 miles of pipeline will have to be built down to the Papuan Gulf to exploit that oil. That will mean roads into the rainforest, into these remote rainforest regions. That could potentially mean logging. And we know that mining and logging are the two things that have the most dramatically intense impact on the destruction of rainforests and the destruction of the cultures that live in the rainforests. But I should say that these people have been in continuous contact with Western ideas, with government, with missionaries. Since the late 1960s, there's been a certain amount of change that's ongoing there. This is not entirely new. In these small-scale societies, we basically find that people want to change. They are very interested in cash. They're very interested in all of the material items of the outside world. They have no way of realizing that something like clear-cutting trees in the rainforest will raise the water level, which will increase the incidence of malaria and really be a major health hazard, could destroy their gardens, and so forth. But when outside concerns come in and say, gee, we'd like to pay you a lot of cash for these trees, people in rainforest regions have no way of knowing what kind of impact this is really going to have on their lives.
My guest is ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Ethnomusicologist Stephen Feld is my guest. What are some of the changes you've seen already in the years that you've been going back to this part of the world?
Well, with the impact of evangelical missionization, which began in the early 1970s, one of the extraordinary impacts has been the end of the ceremonial life of these people. The missionaries found all the costumes, the dramatic and emotional displays of the people, the drumming, their all-night-long song ceremonies, their tradition of spirit mediumship and shamanic performances. They found all of these things terribly suspect and did everything possible to encourage people to destroy or burn all of the artifacts associated with these ceremonies and to cease the performance of the ceremonies.
Well, you actually have a recording of one of the song ceremonies on your new CD. When did you record this? You did it before people stopped performing
it. Yes, people stopped performing these ceremonies in the mid-1980s, and they have not been revived since. So this was recorded earlier in the 1980s. It's the only track on the CD that was not recorded in 1990.
Before we hear an excerpt of this, tell us something about it. And this is a song that is very sad. I mean, even if you don't know what the lyrics are about, you can hear by the singing
right. How
sad it is.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about these ceremonies that were traditionally performed is that the purpose of the songs was to make members of the audience cry. Guests would compose songs intended to make the hosts think of their deceased relatives or think of their former longhouses or places which had very deep emotional resonances or attachments for them. When they would hear those songs, they would burst out in tears, and then they would become so overcome with the grief of the songs that they would grab resin torches and scar the back of the dancer and singer who had composed that song as a way of acknowledging the power of the song.
Let's hear some of a song from a song ceremony.
Yeah.
Is that sobbing that we're hearing part of the song, or is that one of the listener's responses to the sadness of the song?
That's a listener's response to the sadness of the song. What you're hearing there are two costumed dancers dancing up and down. The rattling sound is crayfish claw rattles in their costumes. And they are singing in this echoed, lift-up, over-sounding, overlapping way. And they hardly get into the song at all before a man is just totally overcome with tears of grief and anguish. 20 years ago, his brothers left this area for a labor contract. They were among the first to leave this area, and they never came back. And so the text of that song sings the names of places from the faraway world. He thought of his brothers and was overcome with deep sadness over the loss of those brothers, and that's what moved him to such a profound crying response.
I want to get back to the missionaries. You said that the missionaries were very disturbed by some of the ceremonies they
right.
saw and did their best to convince, with some success, to convince the Kalali to stop performing the ceremonies, and the song ceremony is an example of something that no longer exists. Did they think the scarring part of the ceremony was barbaric?
Yes, they thought that that was brutal. They didn't understand the evocation and the pathos and the dramaturgy of these ceremonies. They also didn't understand why they were important to the people. And the missionaries came to replace Kalali culture with a version of evangelical Christianity, which is of their own devising.
Did you participate in that dialogue at all between the missionaries and the Kalali people?
I've been participating in it in an ongoing way, but it's a very complex dialogue. The missionaries in this area like to say, we're missionaries, we're not theologians. They are not there to discuss the intellectual, artistic merits of Kalali culture with an anthropologist. They're there to change the people and to provide them with alternatives. It also should be said that many of the mission activities are really undertaken by evangelized Papuans who come into these areas and in many cases are much more zealous than the expatriate European missionaries.
You've got to ask yourself, though, I'm sure, if it's your position to try to stand in the way of change, whether that change is the pipeline through the rainforest or missionaries trying to convert the people of the culture. I mean, do you ever ask yourself, do you have a vested interest almost in keeping things the way they are because it's the people who you've studied, you probably don't want to see them change? And I think there's a typical thing that people who study folklore are involved in, too, that they want they want to preserve things the way they are, even when certain people from that culture want to see things change.
Well, I accept change as an inevitable feature of cultural and biological life. Certainly it's been going on in Papua New Guinea for 30,000 years, and the people were always dynamically involved in some kind of change. What I'm really concerned with is survival. I think that it's very clear that there's a relationship between environmental destruction and cultural destruction. We don't question this so much among biologists or zoologists. When they say we're losing 15,000 to 20,000 species of plants and animals a year, when they say we're losing 35,000 acres of rainforest a year, when they talk about endangered species, we don't question them. But why shouldn't we be talking about endangered music? How many songs have been lost this year? How many myths? How many instruments? How much intellectual diversity on the planet is going with this destruction of plant and animal diversity? So I feel that there's a need to see cultural and ecological survival as very connected issues. And this recording is meant to dramatize the extraordinary sound world of the rainforest and this kind of interplay of environmental sound and musical creativity, and through that to ask the question about how the survival of art and the survival of the environment are linked.
Steve, can you choose something that we haven't already played from your CD Voices of the Rainforest and introduce it to us?
How about number 5, the bamboo jew's harp? And what's interesting about it is that the man is playing duet with crickets. and he's playing a duet with the birds around him, and this is a real, another idea of lift up over sounding. You take the sounds around you, and you imitate them, and you become part of them by playing a duet with them, and you'll hear that there's a kind of cross rhythm of the pulsing crickets in the environment and the twanging rhythm of the bamboo jews harp in the player's mouth.
Steve Fell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Feld's CD, Voices of the Rainforest, is on Ryko Disc. This is Fresh Air.